maybe 9 or 10 in one or two places. It'll be cold and frosty again on Wednesday night, dry for most of us again on Thursday, just a few snow flurries across the southeast, and more of the same on Friday, again generally dry and bright but cold. However, it does look as if slowly through the weekend into the early part of next week, it might turn just a touch milder. That's the forecast.
Thank you very much indeed, Alex. Well, our new book of the week, The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison, tells the extraordinary story of the wife of the famous Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev. It's 1920, and Lina and Sergei's affair continues in France, where the pair are living. They are, however, temporarily separated in the autumn when Sergei sails to America. The reader is Sean Thomas.
While Lina applied herself to her singing lessons, Sergei Prokofiev crossed the Atlantic, his thoughts flitting from the delayed opera premiere of Love for Three Oranges to the recitals he would be presenting in California. Sergei was also anticipating the arrival in New York of the Ukrainian soprano Nina Koshets, a close friend whose impassioned singing, especially in her rich, warm, lower range, made him melt. Sergei had pressed for her to be given a starring role in Love for Three Oranges. Although Lina harboured hopes of a singing career, she banished the thought that she could somehow compete with Koshets, at least on stage. Her voice simply did not have the power or depth. Instead, Lina's battle with Koshets would be for Sergei's attention, a frustrating contest given not only his wandering eye, but also his self-obsession. She had succumbed to his magnetism and had the wiles to maintain his affection, so she braved the broad range of other women in his life without protest. His indifference to her needs was the greater affront to her pride. While Koshets enjoyed her success in New York, and Sergei his in California, Lina began to make her way in Paris. She started singing lessons, but found them stressful and suffered insomnia and nightmares of stage fright. To overcome them, she sought some real performing experience. In November 1920, she joined the cabaret La Chauve-Souris, the Bat, headed by the Russian showman Nikita Baliev. Lina was part of a bill that featured skits, Russian songs and choruses, a ballerina imitating a wind-up doll, and various popular dances, nothing risque. The sets were modest, a table and chairs, a picture frame that doubled as a window, a black curtain, and lighting. Lina rehearsed twice a day in the chorus, appearing incognito in a red wig under the stage name Verlet. She also learned Offenbach's aria Chanson de Fortunio, and sang two or three times before Baliev changed the show's repertoire, sending her back to the chorus. Lina was wounded by the change and decided that Baliev was an ignoramus. After just a month, she returned her wig and resigned, unknowingly forfeiting the chance to be part of an international sensation. Instead, Lina returned to her lessons and took comfort in her teacher's satisfaction with her progress. She filled her letters to Sergei with news of her career, such as it was, upbeat reports on the health of his mother, and expressions of how much she missed him. Sergei kept most of his letters businesslike, excluding the more colourful details of his time in California. He glossed over his fraternising in Los Angeles with a young émigré actress, Frou Frou, and his encounters with the silent film star Dagmar Godowski. Lina and Sergei were finally reunited at Victoria Station in London on the 10th of February 1921. They booked separate quarters at the nearby National Hotel, with Sergei doing his part to make the relationship look proper by mussing the bedsheets in his smaller room each morning. He attended to his business affairs and, as Lina predicted, excluded her from his meetings. The slight continued in Paris, where Sergei had to supervise the staging of his ballet, The Buffoon, the first of three productions with Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe. The complete title of the absurdist, fairy tale-inspired ballet gives a fair sense of the plot. The tale of the buffoon who outwits seven other buffoons. Although the dazzling, violent score did not approach the succès du scandale of Stravinsky's ballet The Rite of Spring, it generated enough heckling to confirm Prokofiev anew as a bona fide modernist. Then it was back to work. For Lina, a new teacher, the eminent French soprano Emma Calvé, and private lessons at her chateau in the south of France. But Lina soon became disenchanted. After much agonizing, Lina decided to return to Paris. For lack of better options, she continued her lessons and also served Sergei's career, acting as his part-time assistant, collecting reviews and articles about him in the French press, and summarizing them in her letters to him. Though she grew increasingly resentful of the time and energy that she poured into the relationship, she hid her true feelings until she made up her mind to go to Milan. When she had, she informed him that she was putting her affairs in order, was leaving Paris, and could not continue to trawl the newspapers and magazines looking for his name. Of course, this news was sent by letter, as Sergei was far away again at the premiere of Love for Three Oranges in Chicago. The opera was a success, better than he and the creative team expected. Hoots and hollers greeted his arrival at the podium for the last act. The reviews, however, were derisive. The critics refused to embrace the public's fascination with the prophet of the music of the future and his Russian jazz with Bolshevik trimmings. Lina moved from Paris to Milan in February. She took a room in a pension for musicians in the boisterous heart of the city and for a few weeks relished the theatrical atmosphere. Meanwhile, Sergei returned to Europe with his dissolute poet and philosopher friend Boris Bashkirov, and the two of them decided to hunt for a summer rental in the Bavarian Alps. The hope was that Lina would come as well. Anxieties about losing touch with her had penetrated Sergei's distracted mind, but her desire to get married clashed with his fears of being pinned down. They found a large house in the village of Etal, high in the Bavarian Alps. Convincing Lina to visit the idyllic retreat proved a challenge. Neglected for months and jaded by the 5-to-1 ratio in their correspondence, she had fallen nearly silent. "If I do decide to take a vacation," she wrote, "it will be a short one and not for more than a couple of weeks." The businesslike tone of Lina's letter made an impression. Her mother, she told him, could not understand why he had not proposed to her, and why she still had to conceal their relationship. She wanted to get married. Sergei answered by reminding Lina that he was above all committed to his music, not to any person, and that he was not prepared to consent to marriage if it was not inscribed in his heart. Sergei pleaded with Lina to spend ein paar Wochen in Etal, but he only made matters worse by telling her that he hoped that she would return to being the kind and gentle Ptashka with whom he had become smitten in New York, rather than a bat grabbing at his hair. Despite this insult, she agreed to see him, and in August, Sergei met her at the station, finding her more attractive than ever, and was delighted, indeed relieved, to see her. In Etal, Sergei took pains to make her feel at home, decorating the window of her room with forget-me-nots, forming the letter L. He taught her to play chess and accompanied her at the piano. 2 weeks soon became 2 months, and when they separated again, Lina began to doubt anew his commitment to her. Sergei declared that he loved her, yet he could not, would not, propose to her. Confused and directionless, Lina was unsure of her future. She returned to her pension in Milan and endeavoured to secure her still elusive debut. It came in February 1923, when Lina received a contract for 3 performances as Gilda in Rigoletto. The thought of finally reaching the stage provoked anxiety as much as excitement. Lina was told she had until the 15th of March or so to prepare, but on the 5th of March she was summoned with news that the principal singer had fallen ill. She would take the stage on the following day. Already nervous, she was distressed to learn that there would be no time to rehearse with the orchestra before the performance. She got off to a bad start. In Act 1, Scene 2, during her first duet with the seasoned baritone Arturo Romboli, she lost her place. Lina fell behind in the music, and the conductor did not hold the orchestra back to allow her to catch up. It took her until the middle of the duet to regain her bearings. The fault, she felt, resided with the baritone, who almost deafened her by shouting in her ear. The conductor, Giovanni Patti, complimented her singing but advised her to make better eye contact with him next time. On the 15th of March, she performed without bad nerves, hearing cheers in the middle of Caro Nome about the first flush of love. For the moment, Lina's career seemed on the rise. She posed for one of the best photographers in town, who snapped a dozen shots of her in costume. Under the circumstances, Lina reported to Sergei, I didn't do so badly. I hope to do much better some day and earn a real triumph. In April, Lina convinced Sergei to perform a joint recital with her in Milan, featuring Sergei's Belmont romances, with Lina singing the French translation of the poems. It would be Lina's first performance with Sergei as her accompanist. To Sergei's delight and Lina's relief, the recital was a success. Sergei wrote that he had little hope of Verdi's descendants having a taste for my music. However, it didn't matter as they liked us, and the reviews are proof of this. By the end of May, Lina was exhausted, for reasons that she had yet to divine but would prove decisive. Sergei, too, was unwell, suffering chest discomfort that his doctor attributed to an overstrained heart. The villa in Etal beckoned. There he fell into recuperative silence. In Etal, Sergei discussed the opera The Fiery Angel at length with Lina. Based on a novel by Valery Bryussif, it is one of the most dissonant operas ever composed, dissonance being a cipher in the score for forces beyond human comprehension, and it stood little chance of being produced. Yet in Etal, the couple engaged in role-playing games, strolling through the countryside, acting out scenes from the score. Doubtless they continued their own personal discussions about spiritual and physical love, this time with the opera as focal point. It was a romantic period in their lives, perhaps the most romantic period, which allowed Lina to forget, for at least a moment, the ordeals of the past 3 years in Paris and Milan. In May, the physical side of their relationship triumphed over the spiritual. Lina learned that she was pregnant. Midway through her term, on the 8th of October, 1923, she and Sergei were married.
Sean Thomas will continue reading The Love and Wars of Lina Prokofiev by Simon Morrison at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard.